Thank you. So it was my pleasure listening to all these talks this week. I didn't realize that, you know, when I put my talk together, I think it's a little bit too general, so I will try to fill in as much as I can. I tried actually to fill in a little bit more of the details of my research last night, but that laptop that I have is actually my son's, and the equation audit editor did not cooperate with me, so I will have to kind of explain my research at a party type of thing, as you see on those posters sometimes. So anyway, first, as I think many of you have done, I would like to kind of give a little background of who I am, where I am, and so on. Let me just first say this, trying to paraphrase I think, a famous opening of a famous book, and that is that actually all are one, universities are more or less alike, but every PUI is different or unique, if you wish, in its own way. And I think I had a conversations with a number of you last 3 days about that, how actually when you say PUI, there's this humongous range of the schools, from, you know, big state schools offering a master's program to actually the school where I come from, which is I guess comparing to many schools that you are in, very, very small. So here it is. If you don't know, Goucher College is a liberal arts college, residential, suburban. It's a north suburb of Baltimore called Towson, and it's for many years you might know it as a women's college, but we've been coeducational for I think almost 30 years. Our undergraduate enrollment, I think the number is now a little bit smaller than that, about 1450. And about 130 full-time faculty, and here comes the most important part, and that is my department, which currently consists of three physicists, one theorist, astronomer, and one non-teaching lab staff. We have a physics major, which, as you can see, the numbers of the majors are still up to this year, small, but starting 2 years ago, we suddenly have this quantum jump where we had about, I think, as you can see here, 30 declared majors. So the reason for that, I think, is twofold. I think they're doing a great job of tracking the students, but I think moving to the new facilities and also introducing what we call 3+2 engineering program has helped a little bit in building these numbers. I just want to give you a little history here. Actually, I've been at Goucher for a long time, since 98, and I was hired as only the second person in the department. So when I came there, there was only one person who was teaching intro physics for many, many years. So I, as a new assistant professor, had fortune or misfortune, whatever you want to call it, to actually build up this major, teach all the upper level courses, how that usually goes, and try to do research at the same time. So speaking of research, we actually have what I would call a good thing at Goucher College, that we have actually kind of instituted what we call the research with undergraduates during the summer. We have this 10-week program called Goucher Science Student Summer Research Experience, which is supported both for students and faculty. Of course, not everybody can get it. You kind of have to apply to it. And it's supported by the endowment fund that we have. The idea is that you are funded for maybe a year or two, and then you are to apply to get the external funding. And there are some grants around, NSF, NASA, some of the old Research Corp, Cottrell College grants, petroleum research funds in chemistry, and biology has quite a lot of NIH grants. We have quite a good participation of about 20% of students in science and math participate. In theoretical physics, that one lone theoretical physicist on campus had, as you can see here, 16 student collaborators since 1998, mostly physics students. Remember at the beginning, I didn't even have a physics major, so as some of you I talked about, we picked some math or science, computer science students to work with us. And these are the outcomes of these students. I had 9 of them going to grad school, out of which are physics PhDs, and then the rest is, as far as I know, I have some people in industry, in particular IT industry, government, and a couple of unknowns. I think that, as I already talked with a number of you, kind of it's important to put our research in the context of where we are, and also, as I think we also discussed, and that is that in addition to the research goals that we might have in our research, there are what I call educational goals, and now. When you read these, and I'm not going to read through all of them, these, they look like, you know, these things that we usually put in our research proposals when we apply. But I actually truly believe in this, and that is that engaging physics, math, or computer science students in my research actually provides for them this active learning environment. That it's kind of extension or that is a part of what physics education should be. And then also to just mention that that kind of research that we do, I think also feeds into maybe our other educational interests, like for example, working on this project and applying for in particular, my last NSF grant, I kind of got into looking into the, you know, trying to justify kind to in my proposal why this research, what is the broader impact of my research, and that kind of led me into the teaching a course that I teach now, which is on what I call energy physics and environmental physics. So actually, when my students present posters, I kind of always they include it on their posters. They include this statement that I think it was put out by Division of Energy in their latest, I don't remember what it was, some mid-2000s statement about what I called extreme type 2 superconductors, which have been identified as one of the technologies that offer powerful new opportunities for restoring the reliability, capacity, and efficiency of this old lady up there, which is our power grid. So let me kind of now move on into the research that I do. So my research involves what I call extreme type 2 superconductors in actually high magnetic field, which I am going to define for you very soon. So here it is, kind of quick way of to determine, if you wish, what would be an extreme type 2 superconductor, and that would be the one in which upper critical field in Tesla compares, or it's larger than critical temperature in kelvins, and this particular criterion kind of holds for a number of superconductors, some of them listed over there, non-magnetic borocarbides, magnesium diboride, the old A15s, and certainly high TCs, and also some of the iron arsenides as well. So what is so interested about extreme type 2 superatoms in high magnetic fields. So here it is, what I would call an artist rendering of the HT phase diagram. And so first of all, just to kind of apologize that on the scale here, this HC1 of T should not even be there, because you know, we are talking here a couple of fractions of Tesla versus, depending on which system you're talking about, 10 Tesla or 100 Tesla. But I always get questions from my students, oh, where is that HC1, you know, on that, so that's why it's there. Okay? So, as you can see, there's this blue shaded region here of high magnetic fields and low temperatures, where I will actually, my talk is all about, and where I am going to show you that actually high field and low temperature physics in that pocket differs from that familiar low field semi-classical theory that you might remember from your condensed matter graduate courses. And that is going to be by I am going to show you that in that particular region, that basic difference has to do with the nature of quasi-particle excitations at these low temperatures and high fields. So if you remember that vortex state at low fields, the distance between the vortices, which is defined by magnetic length, is so large that at these low fields, the quasi-particles are going to be confined or localized to in these normal cores, which has to be then contrasted to actually high fields. These are the fields, once again, close to HC2, where these vortices are so packed, they are overlapping vortices. So actually, the quasi-particles in that regime can coherently propagate through many lattices, through many unit cells of the vortex lattice. And that coherent propagation, okay, brings what I call a new physics into this region. So what is so different about that high field, low temperature pocket? And that is that in that high field, low temperature pocket, the lambda level quantization of electronic energies is very well defined and therefore has to be included in the calculation, or rather explicitly included in the construction of the superconducting state. So here it is, kind of visual explanation of that. So if you are in a high field, low temperature limit, and how I define it, that limit, I define that as the region in which either temperature, or what I call the BCS gap, or inverse scattering time, is actually smaller, or much smaller, than the cyclotron energy, which is which has to be contrasted to the low field situation or high temperature situation, where these lambda levels are so close together, so that either temperature or the impurities, scattering from the impurities, will actually erase this this discrete signature of the lambda levels. So, let me just tell you how we put this model together. So, first of all, there should be a dagger here, and it's not, so just put it there. What?
It's your son's fault.
That's his fault, yeah. And there should be a little hat there, so put it there as well. So anyway, so this is your kind of most general mean field Hamiltonian for a three-dimensional weakly coupled S-based superconductor in high magnetic field. So there, this order parameter over here is constructed also from the Landau levels, but these Landau levels, this order parameter now belongs also to belongs to the Landau levels, but these Landau levels are of the charge 2e. So let me put certain assumptions in front of you, because the idea is going to be that we are in this high field limit, we are going to try to diagonalize these Hamiltonian exactly in the in this picture of the Landau levels. So here are the assumptions of the model that I'm going to use here. First of all, since I am working in a very high magnetic field, the magnetic field here in this Hamiltonian, I will take to be more or less uniform because we are talking about very closely packed worked lattice. I am going to, in this, what I'm presenting you here, I'm going to assume that there is no xenon splitting, so this term here is going to disappear. After I look at the clean system, I'm also going to look into the system in which I place the impurities, and I'm going to assume that these impurities are, you know, of course, randomly distributed, and they are non-magnetic. This order parameter that we will be determining self-consistently, we are going to assume that it forms a vortex lattice. Either that lattice is going to be quadratic or triangular, or I can choose that, but I am also going to assume, once I move to the dirty system, that that if I have what I call the homogeneous superconductor, and that's the superconductor in which the coherence length is much, much larger than the range over which the impurity potential changes, that these vortices are not pinned, but rather they still form the lattice. So basically, you know, this problem becomes what I call the extension of that, you know, what you probably remember as a BC theory from the zero field, where you have, of course, the uniform order parameter to the situation with non-uniform order parameter. So I work in what's called the magnetic sublattice representation. That's the one which is characterized by what I call the quasi-momenta, which are perpendicular to the magnetic field. These quasi-momenta belong to the magnetic brilliant zone, and these bases and eigenfunctions have to be constructed in such a way to preserve exactly one electronic flux per unit cell. So here it is. This is my eigenfunctions here. As you can see, you recognize you know, parts of it from, of course, solution for the harmonic oscillator. But, of course, these eigenfunctions are constructed as basically a basis of magnetic translation group. Then what you do, you perform a standard Vogel-Lyubov-Lejeune equations, because which then basically what you then have, if you want to kind of put it descriptively, you have a two-component Schrödinger equation for what we call quasi-particles amplitudes, in which, of course, all the parameter then acts as an off-diagonal potential. Of course, that all the parameter has to satisfy the self-consistently equation. So basically, this is that standard procedure that you have when you are building your superconducting state. So here are your Landau levels. We are assuming that the electron is propagating freely along the direction of magnetic fields. And therefore, we are in a standard S pairing, we are coupling the electrons within a certain window of energy, either electrons that are belonging to the same Landau level, I call that diagonal pairing, or I pair electrons that are belonging to different Landau levels. And how many of these what I call off diagonal pairings I have is going to depend on the ratio basically of that energy that defines the window around which you pair and the cyclotron energy. So this problem therefore becomes then nothing else but the diagonalization of a matrix. That matrix, how large this matrix is defined by what I called number of occupied Landau levels. I call it NC here, which is nothing else but a ratio, an integer of the ratio between your chemical potential, your Fermi energy, and the separation between the Landau levels. You know, this looks like a simple problem. Yes? Sure.
Can you comment on the regime in which you have high magnetic fields but don't have a spin polarized system? Do you have pairings between up, spin up and spin down? But you also have large magnetic fields. So there's some regime in which you're not fully spin polarized, but you have large magnetic fields. Right.
I have not looked into that situation.
Okay.
So going back to this matrix that we have to diagonalize, if we want to do this for any realistic system, this number of occupied Landau levels can be very large. When you are close to upper critical field, maybe that number is going to be of the order maybe a few 10, 10 or 20 Landau levels, but as you move down in the magnetic field, this number becomes quite large and it can run into the thousands. And then, of course, this becomes quite a cumbersome problem of diagonalizing this matrix numerically. Problem can be actually solved analytically in what we call diagonal approximation. Yes?
Can you remind me what big M
is? Big M is the number of Landau levels that you pair around the Fermi surface. So it's the ratio basically between the dye energy and the cyclotron energy. Okay, and so that defines how big this matrix is. This problem can be solved exactly, meaning not exactly, but analytically, in what I call the diagonal approximation. So I throw away all the off-diagonal pairing, which is, of course, not a very realistic situation, unless you are actually in a very high magnetic field, so that that VCS amplitude is much, much smaller than the distance between the than the cyclotron energy. But we can solve the problem in that limit. What is interesting here is that let me start first with diagonal approximation, and that is that the quasi-particle energies, quasi-particle excitation spectrum, is, as you can see from this plot over here, which represents basically these energies, or rather these excitations at the Fermi level. This is the brilliant zone here. And as you can see, these excitations are gapless at a certain point on this magnetic brilliant zone. We have managed to also solve this problem numerically by when we occluded the off-diagonal pairing. As you can see, the situation is, here it is on the right, the case when we have a fully diagonalized the full Hamiltonian. As you can see, there are still these, what they call the gapless points or near gapless points on the at a certain point at a magnetic brilliant zone, indicating that even in S-wave superconductor in high magnetic field, the gap in your momentum space is not uniform anymore, but rather has this structure which actually reflects the symmetry of the or the parameter in a real space. Basically, this is what I want to point out about this high field, low temperature region, and that is that by diagonalizing this Hamiltonian, we have found out that basically we have this this gapless coherent excitations, which you might say, well, what has this to do, how is that different than the famous nodes in a D-wave spectrum? The major difference, the difference is, of course, that these gapless excitations are the result of the center of motion of the Cooper pairs in magnetic field rather than a relative motion, like in the case of D-wave superconductivity. And actually, there are people who have looked into the D-wave case in a high magnetic field only in diagonal approximation, and found out that actually the situation is very similar between D-wave and S-wave in a high magnetic field. This gaplessness of excitation spectrum actually persists down to the fields depending on the system of almost 50% of the upper critical field. And actually, how we know that? We know that from the basically looking what is happening with the Hausman-Alfven oscillations. As you know, as the Fermi levels, as you are lowering the field in a normal state, as the Fermi level goes through the Landau levels, you have this oscillation in the magnetization in the normal state. So if you have a regular, fully gapped superconductor, you would expect when you go into the mixed state that these oscillations will exponentially die immediately. But actually, even in the systems that are known to be S-waves, like, for example, the old A15 superconductors, these oscillations persist down to, depending on the system, 50% or in some system, 30% of the upper critical field. And the only way you can actually understand that is that actually there is not gap everywhere. But rather that gap has to vanish somewhere on the Fermi surface. Yes?
Are there three points that are gapless? Are there three points in the brilliant zone that are gapless, or are there more points? How many points are there?
Remember when you, in the unit cell, the way you choose your basis is such a way that you have exactly one vortex in the real space, so that translates it exactly one vortex in the magnetic brilliant zone as well.
But how many gapless points do you have in the brilliant zone? Like, it looked like you had more than one point that had a closed gap.
Well, I don't, this, maybe I have misspoken. This does not necessarily have to be one single given zone. I mean, my students plot this, you know, so this is not necessarily one.
Yeah.
Okay, it's just for the perspective so that you can see better.
I'm just trying to think what breaks the symmetry in a type 2 superconductor. It's the formation of a triangular lattice, so I would expect that you'd have, like in a D-wave, you have 4 points, right?
Correct.
It's like, that's like the D-wave symmetry, but here you might. But anyway, that was why I was asking.
Remember, this is all due to the magnetic field. So magnetic field is the one that creates these points. So then, once you cross down, of course, to the low fields, these gaps have to open up, and ultimately, as you go lower in the field, in a low field regime, if you're in an S-ray, of course, what you are going to end up is with a localized quasi-particle states in the vortex core. In an S-ray, or you will have extended states like you have in a D-ray superconductor, the famous case. So, of course, this gaseous quasi-particle excitation, which would lead to qualitatively different thermodynamics, transport, acoustic attenuation, tunneling, and so on. Interesting thing to ask is, of course, this is all for the clean system. So what would happen if you put some disorder into the system? So we have investigated that case. Remember, I already told you that I'm going to look into the dirty but homogeneous superconductor. So this is the one where the vortices are actually not pinned, but you still have a vortex lattice, while the amplitude possibly can be changed by the presence of impurities. We treated this problem perturbatively. So, and this is where I have skipped a lot of stuff. So I'm just going to wave my hands here and try to tell you what we do. Basically, you form the you form the Green's functions, 2x2 Nambu matrix, where the diagonals are what's called the normal Green functions, and off diagonal a normal Green's function, and then you dressed them via scattering with what's called a normal self energy here, and what's called anomalous self-energy. As you can see, what I have here, and I didn't mention here what this, so delta NN of Q, once again, is that the gap function, is that right, which is not now uniform, but rather depends on very wide magnetic Brillouin zone. So your off-diagonal elements of your Nambu matrix will involve this particular function there, and so you're basically dressing it with anomalous self-energy. We make certain approximations to actually be able to handle this problem, which is incredibly complicated if you have many, many Landau levels. We are first using the diagonal approximation, so meaning we are actually neglecting the off-diagonal pairing in our superconducting problem. The reason is that the plots, those graphs that I showed you, that there is no major qualitative difference between the two, so why make life horribly miserable and maybe change your results by some small number at the end. The other assumption, which is an important assumption that I'm making, and that is that the scattering does not mix Landau levels. Of course, that's going to be valid as long as that short-range potential that we are using, its amplitude is much smaller than the separation between the Landau levels. So we then use what's known as a T-matrix approach that has been developed a long time ago for the heavy fermion superconductors. So basically, of course, all of this is work in this Landau level basis, which is the complication to this problem. So basically, you write your T matrix, scattering matrix elements in this basis, and then the self energies are then going to be diagonal with respect to this, what they call magnetic sublattice representation, diagonal in that Q quasi momentum. They are going to be diagonal T matrix elements that are averaged over the impurity random positions. So then, this is where I have skipped a number of steps here. Your T matrix has to satisfy the famous Lippmann-Schwinger equation that that then you solve perturbatively. Long story short is that you end up with something that is a nonlinear complex integral equation for self energies. That's basically what gives my students headaches, because this is what has to be solved then if you want to solve it for a realistic system. That means, finding optimal ways of solving this equation. What do I want to say here? So the most important parameters in these equations are the two, which one that I call G, which is nothing else but the inverse scattering rate in the superconducting state divided by the renormalized amplitude of a gap function, and that one is actually, strictly speaking, it's going to be measuring number of impurities that you have in your system, and then you have this other parameter which measures scattering strength. So it's basically proportional to 1 over the amplitude of your scattering potential. So you basically have to solve this nonlinear complex integral equation, and then you feed that into your density of states, and you are trying to see how is your density of states influenced by the presence of these excitations. And here are some results. So we have looked, as you well know, a differential STM conductance is directly proportional to the density of states. So we have looked at one of the borocarbides. What does that mean? Basically, for everything that we need in our system, and that is Fermi energy, effective mass, scattering rate in a normal state, then we can relate to the scattering rate in the superconducting state, is taken from the experiments. And the only thing that we actually, well, in this case, we vary both. We actually vary this other parameter that they call this other parameter G. And so what are the important feature, and what are the actually signatures of these gapless excitations and high magnetic field? Well, as you can see, if you have a fully gapped superconductor, you expect, no excitations. Is that like until until the energy is of the order of the gap? But if you have these excitations in high magnetic field, as you can see, you have these the characteristic V shape. This particular here corresponds to very, very small number of impurities, which is closest to the clean system. And then as this other parameter gets larger and larger and larger, as you can see, you develop this non-zero differential conductance, meaning non-zero density of states at zero energy. What does that indicate? That indicates that these points in the magnetic Williams zone have actually broadened into what I called gapless regions, because you have more and more density there. The second graph, I'm going to skip that one for the sake of. And then here it is. This is this plot shows the differential conductance for the certain disorder parameter G, which corresponds actually to the experimentally measured. We use the experimentally measured inverse scattering rate for that as a function of the magnetic field. So. As you can see, the red one is magnetic field close to the upper critical field, and then we go down in the field. And as you can see, the differential conductance, which once again is related to the density of states, is this dip here is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. What is that indicating? That is indicating that as you are going down in the field, these gapless points, the gap is actually opening at the gapless points. Okay? Sure.
So this is outside my area of expertise, so I just want to get a feeling. So 5.5 Tesla is a large field.
Yes.
So where is sort of the order of magnitude of medium fields, weak fields? What sort of like super large field?
This depends on the system. Remember, for us, large magnetic, what I call high magnetic field is the field that you start. So my theory, most of when people talk about supermagnetic state, they start from the zero field up. What we are doing, we are starting from the high field, right. So we are starting from HC2 down. Okay, so basically high magnetic field for me is the magnetic field which is close to HC2. Okay, so for this system, I'm trying to remember, since I started at 6.5 Tesla, I think the HC2 for this particular system is about 7 Tesla. Okay.
And similarly for the disorder.
For some other system, it's going to be.
Sure, I want to know for these systems, right, where our scale is. So then in terms of disorder parameter, when should I feel like a lot of disorder has kicked in?
So there are two issues. There is a lot of disorder, okay, so increase in the impurity concentration is basically measured by G. So more and more, scatterers, larger and larger G. On the other hand, there is another parameter, C, which measures the strength of the scattering. So weak scattering limit, for the certain reasons, is this one with C is equal to 1. Closer to C equal to 0, that's a stronger, strong scattering limit.
So, right, so there's some trade-off between G and C.
Correct, yes.
So when you've got C equals to 1, should I think of G equals 0.2 as a really disordered system, as a medium disordered system?
I think this G equal to 0.2, I mean, these systems are mostly clean. The ones that we actually look, we have to look in the relatively clean system. So yes, these are relatively clean systems. These are systems in which the Hassmann-Alfvén oscillations have been measured. And in order to measure them, you have to have a relatively clean system. So G equal to 0.2 corresponds to a relatively clean system. Yes?
I probably am completely lost, but if I'm not, then these points with dips in the differential conductance should be places where you have a significant density of states but
correct.
Zero gap.
Correct. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so I followed that much.
Yes.
Where was that on the previous slide, which had... Oh, you didn't show us
No. I cannot show you that because...
But that was showing density of states, right?
This is just my...
The previous was density of states. Oh, no curves?
No curves.
Okay.
What I'm saying, that only from observing these solutions, I can conclude what is the density of states, and therefore I can conclude what is happening to those Kaplan's points. And my conclusion is that now the disorder has actually broadened these Kaplan's points.
Okay. And so is there any intuitive understanding of those complicated equations? Is there any way for you to point to terms and tell us how they got into that equation on the previous slide?
Remember the T matrix is 2x2 matrix, has a diagonal and off diagonal, and these are coupled through this Lippmann-Schwinger equation. So basically we are solving two coupled equations, and I have to make certain approximations.
It's the diagonalization
So,
that gives you this equation.
To be able, so there are a number of approximations that I have made because I have numerically examined different pieces there so that I can actually arrive
to
something that I can solve at the end.
Is the denominator from normalizing the solution? If you go back one, very complicated equation.
Okay.
Does the denominator come from trying to normalize it? No.
No. But, for example, we have also studied this, which I didn't talk about. We studied this in the Born approximation, which is a weak scattering limit. From there, so comparing this and what we get in the weak scattering limit, I can conclude, when C is much larger than this part here, then I know that I'm in weak scattering limit, and that's how I pick C equal to 1. On the other hand, a C equal to 0 would correspond to the, which is actually not a realistic situation to my system. This would be a strong scattering limit. Yes?
You mentioned STM, and that you get some of your parameters from experiments.
Correct.
I'm wondering if you're going to show us any comparison between what you find for conductivity and what is actually found in STM.
I do not have those data here. Yes?
Just a quick question. On the next slide, the last slide that you actually showed us.
Sure.
On the far left, if you have zero doping or no impurities,
mm-hmm.
are you in the regime where you have a fully gapped superconducting state? And then
remember I have those points on the Fermi surface on certain points in the magnetic brilliant zone.
5.5 Tesla, you have a gapless superconducting state.
Correct. Yes. Okay. Yes. That's in that regime close to the HC2.
So in this regime when you have zero bias voltage, mm-hmm. I'm just trying to relate this to having either a gapped superconductor or a gapless superconductor.
Yeah, if you have a gapped superconductor, this would look, remember, like this.
Okay. All right.
So let me skip over that. I just want to acknowledge a couple of people. So over the years, I have benefited with bouncing the ideas from my late colleague at Johns Hopkins University. I want to acknowledge a couple of students. Here's the one from a number of years ago who was actually supported by a research corporation, as you can see over here. He has gone and actually already done finished his PhD at Boston, and I think he's staying there in some kind of teaching position. Then some other two happy students with me. This one is actually a math student who worked with me, and he's now doing applied math at Brandeis University. And my two latest students, Julian Irvin, who is now at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he switched to experimental physics. And Tamiro Villazon, my international student, who is now at Boston University. And thank you for listening to me. And I thought this would take half an hour.
within a factor of two.
Yeah, only well. Yes, please.
It's a kind of a meta question, but I did my PhD in ITC, and when I went to a PUI, I pretty rapidly decided that I didn't want to work in that field because I was going to get scooped too much. And I'm just curious because I think, you know, like the stuff you're doing, I think of as being pretty, I don't want to say popular, but like, do you feel like you're
yes,
in danger of getting scooped
saying,
all the time, or did you find like a little niche or something?
And I think I found this little niche that I know the rest. But I am not claiming that this is the groundbreaking, ground-shaking research, but I think it's good research for me and has been a good research, has been funded, so.
No, that's what I mean. I mean, like, was it hard to find something
that
was so successful, but not, like, so successful that somebody was always
giving it? Yes. Not many people start from this this limit and work in Landau level.
So that was like
the Yeah. Yes, thank you.
You have random non-magnetic impurities.
Yeah.
But it wasn't clear to me how the randomness of the impurities entered the theory.
Because you have to average everything over, the impurities scatter.
Mm-hmm.
You are averaging over all these impurities. You're doing the averaging.
Okay.
So they are not pinning, they are not pinning the water flatness, but you still have a scattering over randomly positioned impurities. So you have to average over that.
So where the positions occur in your theory? The theory is mostly in momentum space. How do you put in, what is that new, I guess?
Here it is. Well, as I said, I am using a short range. I'm using an ultimately short range impurity potential. I'm using a delta potential. So it's sum over I, U naught, well, that's U naught is amplitude, delta function of R minus R, big RIs, where big RIs are random position of the impurities.
So it's true randomness. You actually have position space to calculate.
Oh, yeah.
And you put them anywhere within the cell or whatever.
Correct, yes. Thank you.